I split the Seattle PI route, I delivered the circle in dorm 3, and he delivered through the dormitories. The exception of the dormitories was that number 6, in 1948, the first floor was converted to a grocery store. Prior to that time, all of our groceries were delivered by truck, and they were parceled out by families with boxes and that kind of thing. And there was some kind of a commissary, but I'm not sure exactly where that was. So in 1948, we had a fairly complete store, and the manager, some of us knew the manager was Grant Birmingham, and he was here until he was drafted. He was drafted also, wasn't he, for the Korean War. And his brother Bob were up here. And they built an apartment for them on the back side of that first floor for he and his wife to live in. And the upper floor was still the dormitory.
Is that Lodge 6, you said? Which lodge is that?
6.
6, yeah.
Yeah. And then number 3 up here, I don't remember what year it was converted into apartments for couples who didn't want to maintain a home up in Winston. And that's how there came to be a doorway between pairs of rooms in number 3. And I think they had full cooking facilities, but they did not have refrigerators at first. And the company was supposed to provide refrigerators. And they were very, very late. So now what do you do with your perishable food? And apparently they had to kind of, well, you couldn't do it on this side because this is the south side. But on the north facing side, they could kind of hang the food out the window and kind of keep it cool. But it was a problem. But back to the dormitories, you know, there's always an exception to the rules. When I said it was inviolate, well, you know my brother.
Yeah.
So I got to tell him, my brother.
Yep.
My brother's about 2 years younger than me. Mm. But he never told me in particular, because I'm too much the goody-goody guy. And he obviously never told my mother. But he ended up, because he's delivering newspapers, he befriended a miner down here in number 4. And he sneaked down there, and this guy was a very, very nice guy. In fact, my father knew him quite well. And my brother learned how to play pinochle down in the basement of the dormitory and never told anybody until he was, I don't know, a teenager or something like that after we had left. But this fellow and another guy were, this one particular weekend, were down at Lucerne. And they found this wonderful canoe. It didn't seem to belong to anybody. It was just sitting in the waters down there. And I don't know if anybody knows about Old Town canoes. Old Town made the premier wood canoe. It was the top brand, and always has. They still make canoes. So they brought it up, and John was playing pinochle with them. He helped them work on this canoe. And it had broken ribs, and they repaired that. And the canvas on the outside had to be repaired, and they did all that. And they got a really fine canoe out of it. Well, this fellow Bill Townsend kind of decided he wanted to get a better job someplace else. So he left. He said, John, do you want this canoe? Why, sure. Gave him the canoe. And so Dad and other folks hauled the canoe up to Gumkey Lake and used it for fishing. Well, Bill Townsend came back. The job someplace else didn't work out very well. So he came back, and John says, well, I still have the canoe. I'm going to give it back to you. And Bill says, no, it is yours. I gave it to you a couple of years ago. It is yours. I don't want it back. So he still has the canoe.
He still has it?
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, my land. Still up a donkey?
No, it's not a donkey. Well, we had to repair the engine. In fact, I ended up using it. I ran a Boy Scout tour for several years in Seattle, and we were going up to Ross Lake on one of our 50-milers, and this new trip, about a 50-miler, for a week. So I ended up having to repair it. and there was a serial number written at the bottom of it, so I sent that back to Old Town, and I had to repair the outer gunnels, the entire keel, the two deck plates, one at each end, and other various stuff. Gave them the serial number, and they gave me parts from their factory in Old Town, Maine, to repair it. And then having the serial number, they could tell us the year. It was made in 1942.
Wow. Did they know who bought it originally?
Have no idea.
Oh.
Not even a clue who originally owned it. But we haven't used it for years. It's got the wood has contracted so badly and it leaks so badly we don't dare put it in the water.
Yeah, those are a challenge. My dad had a Willits. And so it was endless patching, and I think you had to put it in the water and it would swell up, and take it out, dry it off, and patch it, and put it back in, and, you know, you had to do that.
It's really tough to do when they're built with canvas. It's a really easy way to do it. And what we had done is patch it with fiberglass, and that kind of thing makes it way, way too heavy.
Yeah.
A lot better doing canvas. Now, Agape up here was the hospital. It had four wards in it. Who's here? Is there anybody who was not in my presentation last night? You were not? Okay. We had a doctor up here continuously, accredited doctor. And the doctor's wife always had to be a nurse. So they didn't have two families involved. And on the east end of that hospital then was the apartment for the doctor and his wife nurse. And then there was an examination room in there also. And there was also another room that was also set up for a dentist. So we had a dentist who would come up a couple times a year, and that dentist was a well-known dentist that a lot of us shared memories of. He's one of the roughest dentists you've ever met. It's really rough. But he had a practice in Chelan for many, many years. Many years after that. In fact, he removed my impacted wisdom teeth, but I had to go down there to have that done. If there was emergency work, even though the doctor up here, in fact, one of the first doctors, a family friend I've been doing for years and years and years, and after he served in World War II, came back to Chelan and he set up a practice in Chelan. He's probably one of the, I think, one of the most revered doctors. Later on, a couple of doctors came in with fairly large families, and so the apartment was not big enough for them, so they ended up living in number 12, and I think then they may have had a separate nurse who might live in the apartment. If there is a real dire emergency, then the miners might have to be taken out sometimes by a float plane and taken down to the hospital in Chelan, and if they couldn't handle it, they'd be taken all the way to the Wenatchee Hospital. On the chalets, we called them the staff houses then, each one of those houses was assigned to generally a specific position on the staff. For example, the big one, like number one, that was the head honcho, the mine manager. And that most people who've been in there, of course, that's a fairly large house. The very upper story was completely open. And I don't know if you knew Johnny Curzon, but that was his room. That was his playroom.
My man.
It was completely open, as I remember. The number two, called the guest house. Of course, this was the replacement because the original guest house burned. And this was a replacement that was completed, 4 years ago, something on that order. Now, the guest house, that's where the head honcho was from New York City. The corporate office for Howe Sound was in New York, and the company was incorporated in the state of Maine, actually. The president of the company was Mr. Sharp, and that's where he stayed. Number three was what we called the staff house, And that's where the bachelor staff lived. And I don't remember too much about any about them. There was one individual who became a fairly strong family friend, Tom Wilson. And he was one of the geologists. He was a single man. They had no cooking facilities or refrigeration facilities in there, so they had to walk in there over here to the dining hall, just like that. Fellows from the Dormitories. But he was a very good skier, and he was our skiing merit badge counselor for the Boy Scout troop. So he was the guy who taught me how to ski. My dad was not really a very good skier, but he was quite good. And we'd go up ski up here on the avalanche area up here, and we set up a slalom course and showed us how to run slalom. That's how I learned how to run slalom gates before I got to high school. Number four was the mill superintendent. He was responsible for all of the operations in the mill and the SA office. The next one up was the shop superintendent. Generally, that person would be electrical, mechanical engineer. One of the last ones that we got to know quite well because they had a daughter my age. But he had a degree in electrical engineering and mechanical engineering. And he ran all the shops at the head of the mill. There'd be a steel shop where they sharpened the drill bits. There's a welding and forging shop, machine shop to repair equipment, take care of electrical motors, and that's why they wanted someone who really had an electrical background, because a lot of the stuff in the mill, for example, was run with electric motors. You know, they had vibrator screens, you had the motors that were running all the ball mills, the cone crushers, pumps, and all that kind of thing. There was huge air compressors that provided all the air for the pneumatic drills inside the mine, operating the ore chutes, operating the air for the flotation vats inside the mill. And there was also an electrical generation standby unit. These were huge diesel engines running electric generators in case the power from slammed. Was interrupted, which did happen, usually only during the winter when we got heavy snowfalls and some of the power lines might come down. The next one up was the office manager, responsible for everything in the accounting and bookkeeping and that kind of operation. The next one up was the mine superintendent. And that person had responsibility for all of the operations underground, all the miners, drilling operations, blasting operations, everything that happened underground. The next one up was generally a geologist, a degreed engineer with a specialty in geology, or a degreed geologist. Number nine was the mine foreman. All the shift bosses reported to the mine foreman, and he in turn then reported to the mine superintendent. The top one was generally reserved for one of the engineers, usually the chief engineer, which is one of the positions my father held. Number 11 was another engineer. Number 12 was one of the accountants. 13 was another accountant. I don't know if you knew the Wilbers.
Yes, very well. Don was in my class.
Okay, and Mr. Wilbur was one of the accountants, and Harriet, in the last years, taught school up here. She was our piano teacher.
Yes.
And they lived in number 13. And then number 14, I believe, generally was a safety engineer for the mill itself. So that was kind of the general idea.
Where did the school teacher live?
up by the other end of camp, up in Winston.
Okay.
For example, Mrs. Field, when she came up here in 1939, she lived up in the middle row, and it was the fourth house. So I'll point that up when I get up. The fourth house on the lower side of the middle room. They lived in that house forever. And her husband had various jobs. The one I remember that he was the operator of the crane on the company dock down at Lucerne. Let's see. What else can we talk about? Let me check my cheat sheet. Linda Jensen gave me this wonderful sheet. She's done this walking tour for several years, and she has this down to a real science.
When was that number 3 up here converted into?
I don't remember when that was. Okay. It was converted, I'm almost sure, after we moved down here, which was in 1945.
Okay.
And there were two rooms repaired. One was to be a kind of a living quarters, and the other one would be the bedroom. It's typical of that. There's a concrete structure up in behind 11 and 12. Should talk about that. That's our swimming pool. That's where we learned to swim. It's only about 15 feet long or whatever. And on the downhill side of it, you see two openings, one on top of each other. And there's a wood-burning stove attached to that. And the water was still cold. But we did fire up that wood stove, and we did heat the water up a little bit, and the water was just circulated by natural convection.
Yeah.
So it was behind those staff houses, 11 and 12?
Yes. Yeah, it's still up there. It's completely filled in with debris right now. But the ladder is still there.
Yeah.
And I have a picture in my mom's photo album where shows one of the kids standing on the edge of that with the ladder ready to dive in.
Oh, that's great. It still has a little bit of blue paint in it, too.
Is there really?
Yeah.
Did you put that in there?
No.
You didn't paint it? Oh, okay.
Is this hot tub a recent addition? This hot tub here?
It was put in sometime in the
70s. Yeah, the hot tub was placed.
Oh,
by the folks here in the sandlot. We did not have anything like that.
Oh. And the other thing we were wondering about was the little stone walls along here. Were those here?
No, these stone walls were not here. So I remember folks here put those in. There was some rockery around. The front rockery was in place down there.
Okay, right, because that was along the road. And
they had to do that.
Right. Right.
In fact, one of my jobs, I worked 2 summers. When I was 16 and 17, and one of my jobs was to go trim the grass down there, among other places.
Right.
But they wouldn't let me run a lawnmower. But when I got home after work, Dad said, mow the lawn.
Okay, whatever. Yes.
Yeah, whatever.
Mine, Dad. So all the brick painting, this was all added by Holden Village. Right?
That's correct.
Because Holden Village was going to use this outdoor space much more than the mine ever.
Yeah, the miners never really collected out here. They were on the verandas and that kind of thing.
Did they have the grass planted, or was it all just bare?
There was grass planted around. And there was grass all around all the houses and everything, and that was one of my other jobs. I had to water the lawns, move the lawn sprinkler around, that kind of thing. It was like most kids have to do.
Did the guest house burn when you were here, or is this in later years?
It burned in later years after the property was turned over. Well, as a kid, some of my experiences down here, the wintertime was all over at Francis. This is a great sledding hill.
Yep.
And what we would do, because we lived in number 10, we finally got a toboggan. And our neighbors in number 9 wouldn't let us build a trench over there, so we built a trench on the porch of number 10. But it wasn't a straight shot, so the toboggan coming, of course, hit the first wall and careened off the sides and all the way down and that kind of thing. It was a great hill. We weren't supposed to sled. during the week because there'd be ore trucks. During the winter time, during the summer, I don't care when it was, there were three ore trucks, and I think they ran twice a day, only during day shift, 8 to 4 p.m. We never ran the ore trucks during the night. And, of course, obviously, you don't want to be running across the roadway with trucks. And the big trick down there was because there was this huge snow berm between the schoolhouse and the rec hall, up way this high down there. The trick was to be able to get enough speed coming down the hill and make it over that hump and go into the creek. Well, we didn't do that. And there were times, you know, we'd try sledding after hours, after the truck stopped running. Except sometimes Mr. Curzon, who was the mine manager who lived at number one down there, would be walking down there, and we'd come across the road, and he was walking home, and he, of course, let Dad know, and Dad let us know. But one other final story. Does anybody know of the Whitaker twins, the mountain climbing people, Jim and Lou Whitaker? They were close friends with one couple up here, Jim and Marion Sullivan. And I think it was Marion who actually lived near them in West Seattle, where the Whitakers grew up. And so they came up here a couple of times, once during the summer to hike up to Lyman Lake and that kind of thing. And they came up here one winter, I think it was right around Christmas time, with their then wives. And back then, of course, Lou was running the guide service on Mount Rainier, and Jim was the manager for REI, Recreational Equipment, also known as the Co-op in downtown Seattle. So anyway, they were at a cocktail party at our house with the Sullivans. And my brother John finally got one of them, I don't know if it was Jim or Lou, to come out and go tobogganing with us. So they get on the toboggan, and I don't remember who was with them, either Jim or Lou and a couple of the others did. And at the same time, they were having a party out here in the staff house. And of course, the walkways, the snow banks are about this high, and you can't see over the top of them. So they come roaring down the hillside. And Mrs. Robertson, who was the switchboard operator up in the office, came out, and just as she came out on the roadway, here comes the toboggan, and wiped her right out with one of the Whitakers on the toboggan. And poor Mrs. Robertson. I didn't see her personally myself, but I understood that she was really, really black and blue and hardly walk. I think they had to drive her to the top of the mill to go to the office to operate the switchboard.
But she didn't, nothing was broken?
Nothing was broken. Yes.
I have a couple of questions. The people that, the managers and all people live in the chalets, do they ever eat in the dining hall with the miners, or do they just all cook their own meals all the time?
Everybody cooked their own meals.
Okay.
All the staff houses had complete facilities, just like any regular home, electric stoves and refrigerators and all that kind of stuff. I believe the families could go into the dining hall, but they would have to pay. And there were times I can remember, it was either, probably Thanksgiving, and I believe there were a couple times where families were invited to go in and eat with the miners, and that was one of the few times that we would do it. Otherwise, no. What we would do as a treat, though, would be to go down to the fountain lunch.
Yeah.
And they had a grill, as I was talking about last night, where they could cook up steaks and hamburgers, and it was really a treat for those kids because we always wanted to go down there on a Sunday night and get the chocolate milkshake and that kind of thing.
One other question I had a few years ago, I was talking with a guy in Chelan, an old-timer, who was telling me that when he was up here, he never worked inside the mine, but he said the paths between places, sometimes they just let them, you know, they cover, they, they would cover, they wouldn't shovel, they'd shovel it out for a while, and then when it got deep enough, they just cover it with plywood, so you're walking in through in tunnels.
I don't remember the plywood. Oftentimes, the snow was deep enough, and it would get hardened enough that you just have an archway of snow. I don't remember the plywood deal, but they could very well have done that.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever seen the Life magazine issue of, it was in 1956. And I think that was the year of the record snowfall. It was something like 50 feet of snowfall up here.
56 and not 55?
It may have been. It was 55. Yeah, it was 55, 56, I guess it was. Yeah. I think it was that one. And I think it was actually the issue of, I think it was in Life magazine early, 56. But it was that winter, yeah. And there was a snow. Particularly in the Winston houses, way up to the roof level on the ground. I don't know what the depth was. I don't remember what the depth was actually on the ground.
Yeah.
People said, it was 50 feet on the ground.
Yeah.
No. It was deep, but not that deep. And there was a lot of homes. In fact, our friend Jim Sullivan, I think it was a picture to his house. And there was just a huge, huge archway of snow that they would walk under to get into his house.
That's how we got into our basement, Chelan.
Yeah, just shoveled
and our daylight.
There were some snowfall years where it was pretty bad. I can remember one year where they got a huge, huge amount of snowfall. And you know, usually, like in the Cascades, we have a real problem with snowfall. Particularly when it involves skiing. I've been a skier all my life.
Mm-hmm.
And you get this really big snow dump of wonderful, wonderful snow, and then all of a sudden it always warms up in Cascades. Always warms up. And of course that just makes for huge, huge avalanche danger conditions. And we were shut down for a month, not for a week, because of the bad snow slides down. They brought down all kinds of debris, rocks, trees, you name it. And they had to walk supplies across the slide from one side to the other. And fortunately, there was equipment on both sides so they could bring the freight up from below. But they couldn't move any ore, of course. And they were getting, they had to shut, I don't know if they shut down the mill, but I think they had to figure out how they were going to stockpile the ore concentrate and figure out how to catch up on their transport going in and out. It was kind of interesting along that line reading one of the annual reports. You know, the place was shut down when they were trying to develop it before the first war. And it was in after the shutdown in 31. But there was one of the annual reports in 1935 was kind of instrumental in trying to make sure this place would be safe. There was one family up here who were the caretakers, but they didn't stay up here. There was a couple of buildings clear at the other end of Winston. But during the winter, they would set up down in Lucerne. And according to the report, that night there was a huge, huge snowfall. And there were two trappers that come down the valley from Langan Lake. And they stayed at one of the houses. And there was about five houses at that time. Just the other side of Winston, plus the generator building. And it was one of those big, heavy snowfalls, warmed up, snow slides all over the place. And it came down, damaged or destroyed all five of those homes. They were in one of them. They got buried during the night. And the generator building was unscathed, so they went over there to spend the rest of the night. They scared to death and then walked out. But what people had observed, that with all the slides, they come down both sides of the mountain, across the creek, and up the other side, up there. The area that was proposed for the Winston camp was unscathed, no avalanches there. There were no avalanches for the proposed mill site, which was yet to be built. And no avalanches down here. So I said, hey, we've got good sighting.
Yeah.
But they had a quarter mile wide slide up there. They did take out one building, a warehouse up at Honeymoon Heights, but as I said, it was a quarter mile wide. Down the road, there was 4 continuous miles of slides. And of course, the caretaker was down there, had to come back up here and observe all this stuff. I thought that was kind of interesting from the report. Well, that was in the 1935 report. So, why don't we take a walk? Any other questions down here? So, why don't we
walk? I can ask a question while we walk. When people lived up here, could have guests come up and stay with them?
Or? Yes, it was unlimited.
Okay, but not the single guys.
They could have guests, but they couldn't stay with them. I don't know where they would house them.
Okay.
For example, my grandparents came up. I can remember came up a couple of times to stay with us. My dad's sister and my mother's brother. So that was really quite frequent that would happen. Sometimes I guess the guests came up and a particular family might not have room. They might find a friend family who would house them for the time being.
Was there much of a separation between the management and the non-management people in terms of sort of like a class system?
I think to some extent there probably was. I was kind of isolated on that. I did not observe that.
Yeah.
It was, I had a couple friends down here, but oftentimes I did not. A lot of my friends that I grew up with were up in Winston.
Yeah, or you're close to.
Yeah.
Once you went home from school, you pretty much stayed up in that area. You didn't come back down here to hang out or anything? Once the school day was over, you walked back home, right? And then
I lived down here most of the time.
Oh, most of the time you lived here, okay.
Right. When I went to school, my very first year, my first grade, we lived up in Winston then. We lived up in Winston for 3 years. And so second grade and on, I lived down here.
Last night you mentioned that the Boy Scouts climbed Copper Peak.
Well, actually it wasn't the Boy Scouts, it was just a group of friends on Copper Peak.
Oh, I see.
The Boy Scout group was back in, it was approximately 1944, I guess. In fact, I was talking to the cousin, one of the fellows who was in the Boy Scout group at that time, and they did, as a troop, climb Glacier Peak.
I see.
But that was the only time that I know of that the Boy Scouts actually did mountain climbing. As a Boy Scout, I did not. So when I did Copper Peak, we in fact had already left. And I came back that summer to specifically climb Bonanza.
Okay.
But that summer, the glaciers and the snowfields were rotten, and our mountain climbing mentor, Jim Sullivan, says, no, we can't do that, so instead we climbed Copper Peak, and that's when I showed a picture of the two others that were with me, and that fellow, and then there was an intern worker actually came with us too. He was a fifth person, wasn't showing the picture, but he free-climbed the cliffs on this face here.
Is this the way that you guys went up?
Yeah, we went up to Honeymoon Heights. Eventually ended up on the big dump up there that you can see right from here between the trees, which is the 800.
Okay.
And then we went up the main chute on the left side, I believe, trying to make sure we weren't directly above and below each other for falling rock. Then we went all the way to the cliffs up there, and you can see a ribbon of continuous trees that goes around to the east shoulder. And there's a meadow right in there that you can follow right around. You come quarter around the backside.
Okay.
Kind of. And then from there, it's just kind of a scramble up right up to the top.
So from the chute, you went to the left, right?
You ran around to the left side.
Okay.
Yeah, you don't want to go around to the right because that's sheer rock cliffs on the right side okay. down into the Big Creek Basin.
So after what we can see here, the climb gets a little bit easier. There's less, technical climbing.
There really wasn't technical climbing as I remember. We roped together just for safety reasons. And Jim said, well, we could have really done that without ropes, but he felt a lot safer if we were really roped together. But he seemed to be very comfortable that he could have climbed around there. Of course, he was an expert mountain climber himself. But it wasn't that difficult. That was the one and only time that I have ever been rope climbing with a rope. I've never done it before that and never done it since. And he showed us how to do it on that one trip on the fly, how to tie into a rope and how to handle it and how to belay and all that kind of stuff just on that one trip. So he had a lot of faith in his ability and what he felt that we could handle. So it's not a very difficult climb as I remember. And prior to that same year, prior to that particular climb, he had already led some teenagers around the backside of Copper, and they had gone up to Fernal,
okay.
which is a little bit higher. So that can't be a very difficult climb either, because that was the first climb for those kids before I got up there that summer.
Fernal's not that difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't appear to be.
Was mountain climbing a pretty popular activity among the miners?
No, it wasn't. I was talking with Laura. Her father was a mountain climber. And very early on, there was fellows like him. He had a couple of climbing partners, and they climbed... In fact, I have pictures of him on top of Bonanza. And Mr. Penberg, is there anybody here from the Seattle area? You are. I don't know, have you ever heard the Penberthy name? Probably a little bit before your time. Way back when, Larry Penberg, he was an expert climber, and he was a member of the Mountaineers. And he had a big row with REI, the mountain climbing gear supplier, one of the biggest, or one of the biggest in the country. Having to do with the wood handles on ice axes, and having to do with how to test ropes, particularly dynamic testing of ropes to make sure that they were strong enough. So he started a firm called Mountain Safety Research. So he did a lot of testing. Anyway, so he was a fairly expert climber and knew all about him. He had a partner up there, but that was very early on. He was here 1938 to 1941. Some of the geologists were fairly good climbers. I can remember one in particular because I now have his photo collection that he had from up here. And he was free climbing. He didn't even use ropes. And in between, I don't know of anybody who did any mountain climbing. I can't remember anybody who did it. It wasn't. Most of the activity during the summer was just standard trail hiking, backpacking, and camping out.
Was that the cabin up at the Heart Lake? Was that here before the miners? Did the miners establish that kind of like the fishing? You know that little right before you get to Heart Lake on the across the creek, there's a cabin back in there with red waterfalls.
There's still a cabin and there's a ruins.
It's still there, but it's all falling apart.
Yeah, that's the one I remember when I was a kid. I think that was an old prospector. There is a history on that, but I don't know what that is.
Yeah. This little water wheel that sits down here by the concrete wall, was that something that you guys used here?
No, anything down in here was what the village put in. The mining company didn't have anything down here.
It was
us kids were never really allowed on the other side of the creek because this was all a mining operation. We really were supposed to go by ourselves beyond the footbridge or even beyond the truck bridge because of heavy equipment running in all the time. That doesn't mean to say that we didn't. We weren't supposed to climb up to the mill without adult supervision. My mother used to take us up through the mill, and we'd go through the trails up there by the, where the water tower is now, and there was a trail which still is there up into Copper Creek. And we'd go up there and go huckleberry picking, which was very popular with a lot of people. However, there were occasions when I did go up through the mill, because I was just so fascinated by all the rotating machinery and the bubbling and the flotation vats, you know, it was just a great place. And there was at the head of the mill, there was kind of a veranda and steps leading up to it, and you were high above all this equipment. And you know, back then there was not this maximum 4-inch spacing, you know, like this on the railings, you know, you could just tumble right off. But I can remember going up and it was scary as the devil looking down, but you could look down there and watch the ball mills rotating, and it was really neat.
Fascinating.
Then I walk up through there, up to the top of the mill, walk over and go over to the engineering building and go up the stairs because the engineering was in the top floor, and walk down to the office and say, "Hi, Dad. What are you doing here?"
Yeah.
But he didn't tell your mother.
Oh, he told my mother.
Oh, he did. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Would your dad ever take you through the mill and kind of explain to you everything?
Well, somewhere along the line, actually, interesting question, because when I was in eighth grade or thereabouts, I actually wrote a paper, if you will, explaining the processing in the mill. And that ended up someplace, and my mother always saved stuff. I can't find it, because I wanted to take that out, and knowing what I know now, did I know anything then? But I can't find it. But yeah, we did. I remember as a Cub Scout, actually, they provided tours for us, and I still remember going into the electrical generation room and seeing these huge diesel engines. And they also took us into the blacksmithing shop. And we had little projects that we could do as a Cub Scout. For example, cutting out tin with tin snips and learning how to do that and make a funnel and do soldering. And we learned to put steel into the forge, get it red hot, put it on the anvil and try to beat on it with a hammer and make simple things like nails and that kind of thing. The footbridge actually put a cover on it in the spring of 1948 when we had these huge floods, and the water didn't come up on the road. We practically took out the truck bridge, one end of it, in the corner, dropped down in the water, and they had to cable it to save it. The footbridge was taken completely out. There was a log jam formed down at the east end of tailings number 3. The water backed up, went all the way around the cribbing, and then ate away the tailings, and there was a huge amount of tailings that got washed down in the creek, went all the way down to the lake, and for years and years after that, everything downstream of there was coated with the heavy orange stuff, which killed the vegetation, which killed the insects, and there were no fish. And what was interesting, a few years after that, and I think it was the first reunion that we had up here, I was happy to be sitting in the bus with this longtime friend, Nigel Adams, who wrote the original pre-production history for the place that I use so much. And I used to go fishing and backpacking with him, along with my brother. And he says, "Bill," he says, "I've been fishing out here. I've been catching big fish." And you know, Nigel and his father always caught fish all over the place, and they never told anybody how they did it. And I thought,
Well, Nigel, is this another one of your great big fish stories? He says, no. We were catching cutthroat or rainbow this big, he says. There's great fish in there. So it did come back.
What year was that?
Let's see, that would have been...
77.
That was our 20th, wasn't it?
That was the first day.
I think it was that day trip that came over here.
It took a while.
So that was about 30 years after that flood.
Yeah.
Wow. The bridge got partially wiped out 1 year. This is all grown up in here now. This was an avalanche chute. It goes all the way up to Martin Ridge. And that, Linda kind of remembers, but I think I was living down here at the council at the time when that snow flood came through here. And after that, teachers would escort the children from up there down to here and then back after classes in the afternoon. But this was our favorite ski area up here. So I got a couple of stories about this one. There's a tongue of trees over here, so as long as we stuck to the trees, we were okay. But usually what we would do is wait till the avalanches that brought all the snow down and everything was very stable. And this friend of my father's, this is Fink Clark again, his son walked up in there. Well, up here in the engineering office, they were high enough up the ground and they had binoculars up there, which they were accused of using during hunting season so they could spot the deer and figure out where the next deer was going to be and go pop one off. So he was watching his son. He said, "Yeah, that's got to be my son." Well, Duncan went up to the falls. This was in the spring. And, of course, the water coming down, it undercuts the snowbank, and it went poof. And Duncan ended up down inside. Well, unknown to them, they didn't watch long enough. They sent a rescue party down. Meanwhile, Duncan crawled on out and went home. But he was still on deep duty.
Yeah.
Well, one time I was out there skiing by myself in the spring, and snow slides had all come down, and it snowed a little bit. Everything looked really smooth and great. So I got up there, and I didn't go quite as far as the falls because I knew that was a dangerous place to be. So I pointed the skis downhill. Down I came, whoopee, 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 too. And then I got down to the foot down here, and there was these snowballs like this in holes. And I stuck a tip in, and I did a full face body plant, blam, and I just laid it. And I finally got up, and I was kind of shaken up. So I said, well, this is not very good. So I walked out down here and went back home. That came home that night and says, "That was a terrific ski run you made today, Bill." There's another spying on me.
this is an example of us kids could not do anything. But somebody knew about it. I mean, by the time we got home, it was like, well, did you have a good time?
Oh, yeah.
It was the same in Chelan.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, what I used to do, and at least I was smart enough to realize avalanche conditions and that kind of thing.
Comes across.
Several times when we got big snowfalls. And,
This is spruce bud worm. We had an expert here talking about that last week.
And then other than that, there's a deep freeze for like a week.
It's, it comes, it happens about every 30 years. It comes through and kills some of the trees, but not a high percentage.
Yeah.
And it's, so it's not going to really impact significantly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't remember when we were living up here.
You said the last one was 30 years ago. Is that then?
What's that?
70s.
Still with it.
So, and then the other previous one being 40s sometime.
40 years ago.
Do you realize how much these trees have grown and what these people can't see now that we could see in clear view?
Was this area ever logged way back?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, a fire went through there, and then the Swiss loggers came in and logged, did aerial logging down. Just above the switchbacks, they had an area there. That, as far as I know, was the only time.
Hold it for more than that. You were talking about last night, the fish practice was burning, you know, setting fire to the area, just so they could see what see what they're looking at.
Oh my gosh.
So there's a great picture you can see where it's all bare.
Wow. And that was when?
Those were amazing.
I want to say 1910 or 1909.
Yeah.
Maybe earlier.
Oh my goodness.
But I mean, it's like, and then they. I lived up here during 1950.
And you could stand there. I'll talk a little bit about the mill, but if you want to come this afternoon, I'll talk a lot more detail. But just to point out some, there's a, I don't know if you can see it, but there's a big steel bin at the very top. That's where the ore trains dump the rock ore into this big bin at the top, and then they shoot below that, and it fed the ore into the first stage of crushing. And at the very bottom, and I can't hardly tell myself right here, but if you've walked up there, down at the, near the bottom, there is another great big steel bin, and I believe that was the concentrate dryer. You can't obviously see the museum building from here because it's in behind those trees. But it was sitting, it is sitting on what was formerly the concrete pad for the assay office. And then there was a breezeway from the assay office to the bottom of the flotation baths. And then from there, the samples could go directly out to the flotation baths and take a sample of the froth, which was about the concentrate coming up off the top. And they go in, every 2 hours they had to do this according to what Pettenberg can go down. And they'd have to analyze that, and I would assume that taking those results, that they can then adjust the concentrations of the reagents that were being used to separate the copper or, which is a compound, not pure copper, from the rest of the material to make sure they got the highest concentration levels they possibly could. They also took out quite a bit of zinc, and let's see, I guess the numbers are not here, and a little bit of silver. They tried to do gold for a while, and that didn't pan out, so they forgot that.
What were the reagents used?
Oh, you would have to ask.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the primary agents is pine oil. And that whole place, pine oil. And the whole place would smell like a pine forest. The reason for the pine oil is that that's what creates the froth. And the copper kind of automatically gets attracted to the bubbles. And it's very highly bubbling stuff. And that comes over the top of the bath. Over the edge of it, goes down to a concrete ledge, and then to the next set of vats, and I don't remember how many rows. It was all a gravity feed type of system. They used cyanide and xanthate, both of which are highly toxic chemicals. But they also have the property that for both of those, that as soon as you put them in water, even right here, they immediately turn into harmless compounds. So this. If that is not a problem, even in the tailings area. But the cyanide was then used to help separate when attached to the copper ore with the compounds that are formed when it's mixed with water.
And the xanthate, I think, was for the zinc and silver, is that right? And I don't even know what it is. All I know is the name, and that's about all I know. The other prominent one they used was lime. And, of course, that was used to reduce the acidity of the concentrate in particular. And, of course, that's what they're going to be using in their treatment, water treatment processes when they come back and put in the wastewater treatment plant. So the treatment plant up here at the east end where the lagoon is, and the west end, and there's going to be a big treatment plant down here on the flat, the other side of the creek, next to the parent number three, and they're going to construct a bridge at 10 Mile, then across the new road, new bridge across the creek to this treatment plant. That's the latest plan that they were talking about in the public hearing.
In the tailings,
it
looks like there's a lot of iron in that.
There is. The copper ore here is called chalcopyrite, which is a copper iron sulfide. And there's also a lot of iron sulfide or fool's gold that naturally occurs with that mineral. And so it's the iron primarily that changes everything to its orange color. It's not the tailings itself. So both the west and the east tailings are colored. And of course, all the former rock dumps on the face of the mountain, of course, have a lot of iron in them, including what you can't see. If you were to be able to trace a line from, say, the 800 to the 500 to the 300, to the original point of discovery, where the outcropping is, it's ongoing to occur too.
Where is that original outcropping about?
I cannot figure out precisely where it is. If we figure maybe 2,000 feet up, it might, I don't know if it's that sharp slot on the left side up here or maybe lower off a little bit, but it's over in that vicinity. I think we'd have to look again over there at the truck bridge. We might be able to spot it.
Is it close to the top of the Honeymoon Heights Trail?
Well, the point of discovery? No, it's up here. Over here, there's the biggest dump you see over here is what is called the 800, which is 800 feet down vertically from the original point of discovery. Approximately, just round about to the 100. The farthest west one is the 1100, and at that time it actually was the main shaft. Right below that is kind of a ledge area, and that's where Honeymoon Heights is located. So you go at the base of that 1100.
But if you follow the trail, it goes above the actual Honeymoon Heights up to a couple of trailings higher up.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there's still a vestige of that trail that goes all the way up to the area. Norm Day was telling me that he has been up there. In fact, he thought it was even wide enough to even drive a truck up there.
Really?
Yeah. Oh. Kind of surprising. Mm-hmm. Any other questions relative to ground? Okay.
Yeah, how about this little cube?
I could send up a
couple of ditches over there, and it's coming back way up.
One of the things we're doing, one of the things this land school got really tall, was coming up this October 4th, we're talking to the outdoor school up here.
Yeah.
And they asked us to teach you to make that freezing heat center behind the heat. And so, one of the things I'm hoping for is some of the summer that might be great for the water parts, and it might be really good to see you, but if you can have it, it's going to be very helpful.
So, videos which cover the history. And I'm going to be hopefully sending a package of those up here too.
Okay.
There was a there is a set of those four DVDs in the museum archives. Larry said he had a set of those.
Okay.
So that's another thing that we can use, because those are split up into the various segments of the history.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, why don't we stop right here, because I'm going to go up to 5 minutes.
Teddy's name.
Oh.
But see, Dad was just kind of improving that. So one thing, the front step to our house was rock, and he just flattened it out. And
oh, and said, how?
Yeah. It doesn't make any difference.
So was this part of the first road?
This was the main road. Okay. This was This road was also washed out in 1938. There was about four things basically that happened along from here all the way down to the state of Kansas City. And this part got washed out in 1948. And I don't know where the company got the thrill, but they did. And they filled it back in through the creek. I don't think they put any foot inside tripping or anything else at the bottom. So from then until this 1946, this road was complete and usable all the way to the ballpark area, drive trucks and everything up today. This, of course, was the bottom row up here, and the bottom row of houses that I showed were right along here. And it's just a single row of houses. And the most prominent feature, of course, is this rock wall over here, and what we called was Annie Folk's house. And those very prominent figures in practically all the photographs that you ever see that are taken from that corner there. All these trees have grown in since, so everything's obscured. And part of the stone wall that they had built starts right over here and curves quite a ways up the side road there. I lost my thought. I was going to say something else. But anyway, we'll go over here to look at the Forest Service building.
Mm-hmm.
That was the campfire room cabin. That's where they met. And I was told that that cabin was moved from down the road someplace, and I don't know exactly where it was, so I really don't know.
The same building?
Same building.
Do you remember the road, Old Dusty?
No.
Okay,
back behind there, new one's supposed to go there.
Oh.
That's another.
No.
Yeah, but we didn't.
Why not?
Sure.
Well, I don't remember the name, but I remember the road back there.
Okay. That cabin, I think, was back down there towards Turnwell on that road.
Perhaps. I had heard that the building was way down the road, the other side of the town site, originally.
Wow.
I don't know. Well, you hear all kinds of stories.
Yeah, this is where everybody goes to.
But one of the stories here was, and I don't know where the first Campfire Girls met, you know, when Mrs. Field was heading up. They may have met in the schoolhouse or at her home or whatever, because I don't think they met here, but I'm not sure. I was going to ask Mary Ellen about that, but I forgot to.
I never have been in that one.
Well,
all, you know. All the bluebirds, the other things were held in private homes.
Yeah. Well, you know, that picture with my mother.
Yeah.
And she was the counselor for the Girl Scout, for the Campfire Girls for about 2 years. And I was in the Boy Scouts. And Boy Scouts were supposed to know how to build fires. Guess what my job was? I said, you're going to help us build fires. Because my mother was not a very good fire builder. And I was supposed to be the expert, I guess.
So you taught the Campfire Girls.
So I had to come up, and finally we taught couple of Campfire Girls to build fires.
Build a fire.
I got out of that chore.
Oh, dear.
Oh, yeah.
Do they have Girl Scouts
back there? No, there were no Girl Scouts up here. It was just strictly Bluebird and Campfire.
Campfire, yeah.
Girl Scouts were in other areas. I think Girl Scouts had been formed by that time. And then we had Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts. Troop 55.
And that's all they had in Chelan, was Bluebirds. Yeah.
And we frequently got together with troops in Chelan. I can remember we would pair up oftentimes with Don Morse's troop.
Oh, I'll bet.
And in fact, I remember one year I decided to stay at a camp. We had a Boy Scout camp, still is operating up in above Wenatchee. It soon still is, Scotta Vista. Up near Mission Ridge ski area.
Yeah.
And I remember going down there in the wintertime, just on the winter camp to Scotta Vista before the ski area was there. And we skied out there in the wintertime all the way out to even into Bomber Basin.
Great.
And one year I decided to go there for 2 weeks. I went with my troop, and then I stayed with Don Morse's troop for an additional week. Don Morse was, the reason we talk about it, Don Morse was probably one of the most premier Boy Scout leaders in the Northwest. He was a great, great, great guy. And he's Scoutmaster, 25, 30 years?
Long time.
He finally retired, and everybody got together and bought him a pickup truck, as I remember.
I remember that. They presented it to him at the Friday night football game.
Oh, is that right?
Yep, and he just stood there with tears running down his face.
I'll bet.
He couldn't believe it.
Yeah, he was a great guy.
He was.
But this was in Chelan.
Yeah.
There were, at that time, there were two troops in Chelan. There was another fellow by the name of Harris who ran the other one. And oftentimes, when we went down for Camperee, we'd go down on a Friday, so the men would have to take Friday off and Monday off to support us. And then we'd go to the Camperee over Friday night, and it was off the other side of Chelan, north of Chelan, actually, in what's called the Washington Creek area. And then we'd come back up the boat on Monday morning. Well, Camperees normally are Friday night and a Saturday night. That's the way most Boy Scout districts do it. So we'd have to stay with other families in Chelan on Sunday nights. So that's how we got to know a lot of the people in Chelan. Well, we couldn't get to them in time because you break camp normally, and you have your award ceremony and all that kind of thing on Sunday mornings. And that would go beyond the departure time of the boat.
Dad was going to, he was that close to Eagle Scout, and then the war.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, and he wanted to go with Uncle Joe, who was 4 years older, but my grandma said she wasn't signing anything. He needed to finish high school.
Yeah. Well, it was tough to do.
Yeah.
I got as far as life, mm-hmm. and just barely got the number of merit badges just to do that.
Yeah.
But
four of us, my brother and I, Nigel, I don't know if you knew Pat Sims.
Yes.
The four of us went to Jamboree at the Irvine Ranch in Southern California. And cool. that was a really great experience to be able to do that out of here. That was fun.
That's cool. Dad helped Don in a lot of things. So.
Yeah.
It's great.
But this is another sledding deal. It was kind of a no-no because you end up down here on the truck bed, which I did a couple of times. And I think Jerry Paulson told us a story about how he almost went right under Chief Sims' fire truck and got a chewing out, which is regular from Mr. Sims. But Mr. Sims was our elected constable, and I think in that position he was actually paid by the county.
Oh my God.
And then he was also our fire chief, so he was all
double
the years
dipping.
Here. He was called the chief.
Yeah.
But among his duties was also to take care of the softball field. That was kind of another story. But he'd go out with a screen behind his pickup truck and level it out, and he'd water it, put the lines down, the bases out for the upcoming evening's baseball game or softball game. Well, his kids like to go up there and play softball also. So we go up there, hey, the lines are all laid out. Man, this looks great, and it's all leveled out. We start playing baseball or softball. So we come up, check on things, movie water sprinkler, and he'd find us up there playing on his diamond. So we were in trouble again.
Oh, dear.
And one of the tricks was to go all the way up to the top and slide all the way down, and it was very scary, way too fast. With the homes that used to be in here, now the foundations are gone, the village has turned up this area here for a septic system drain field, and of course they had to pump into it. So all the foundations up here are gone as a result of that. Hey, an artifact.
The mine is probably welded.
Yeah, yeah. They would have. It would have been done up here most likely. But you can find all kinds of artifacts running around up here. You might find wash basins. Up at the other end, I remember years ago, I found an old water heater near where Darlene lived, the Clintons next door. There used to be a bathtub in the weeds. And I have a sequence of pictures that everybody gets a chuckle out of. I think it was Pam. And I have a picture that her mother gave to me of when Pam was really small, washing or bathing her in this wash tub or a bathtub. And then years later she came up and she found the same bathtub sitting in the bushes. She sat in it. Someone took a picture of it and her mother gave me a copy of that one too.
That's great. I'm surprised they didn't want it. Out your way.
But for heating the homes, there were two ways of doing that, firewood, and they'd have to buck up a couple of cords of firewood. But there was also, some homes also had oil-burning furnaces.
Mm.
So every, now in some of the places you'll see a filler tube, I think there's one sitting over there, a filler tube for pouring in the oil. The tanks generally were underground, and a vent tube coming up.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Is this your play area here?
One of them.
Uh-huh.
Completes and reset the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
You go up the top row and open like this, and that was another play area.
Oh, okay. I don't remember those for some reason. Of course, I was down there. And
is there playground equipment?
Yeah. Uh-huh. They tried to keep the kids here, but the kids were like all over.
Did you guys have that leaky?
I don't know of any rattlesnakes up here. I think it was a little bit too high. There were rattlesnakes down at Dumpy Lake, in that area in there, mm-hmm. and even around the lake. But you know, in all the years of living or being around mm-hmm. the areas up here, I have never seen a rattlesnake out in the open, even over at Meadow Creek, which has rattlers. I showed that picture last night of the Conn's house. It was in the corner right dead ahead of us, and she was walking up the stairs to her yep. her home. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine walking up here with snow this deep?
Oh, is this the path that she was taking?
Yeah, this was a complete road.
Yeah.
It's, of course, it's overgrown right now.
Yeah.
But they had to take the cats up here and plow from all the snow from there. They dump it in these areas, but they had to plow that road all the way down, all the way to the bottom. This road was plowed. You know, one of my pictures was taken right from here, and there was a girl standing there with a dog and a couple of cars over there on the left side of the road, and that was taken right from this point. But like I was saying then, we were not allowed, well, the families were not allowed to park their cars on the roads during the wintertime, because they had to keep them free. They had to be able to plow the road, and of course the cars would be in the way of doing that. So you either had to have a garage to put your car in, or take it down the road and put it under the trees for the winter at Lucerne. Of course, they'd have to take the batteries out and that kind of thing.
Does this road go clear on up? Can you walk around? They're up there.
Yeah, you can walk partway around, except just to where the springs come across the road, about halfway across over there. And I haven't done that for probably 15 years when I walked through over that, and it was just a huge thicket of stuff. You could hardly crawl through that area over there. It's grown over really badly. But if you do get over in that area, just the other side where the Hipshires and those folks used to live, there used to be hot water tank and other stuff that's kind of floating in what used to be a basement, because all those old concrete basements just got flooded. And you know, there's a huge amount of water that comes off of these cliffs. And all the gutters and everything else had to be continuously kept clean and clear of debris to keep water from going into the homes.
I saw the hot water tank yesterday. I wandered up that
way.
Yeah, I found it's pretty long and slender.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
They make great watering troughs.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And,
put them into it.
Up there you'll find, if you want to walk up in there, there are these rock walls up there. I think you can find initials of people up there. One place up there, there used to be one of those spider-type clothes hangers. Mm-hmm. And other clotheslines up there. There was a few things kind of left when they had to destroy, take the buildings out, which was an agreement between the company and the Forest Service, that when the company shut down operations, everything up here basically had to be, well, with the homes anyway, had to be taken down. And so they were all bulldozed into piles and all burned.
Does this belong to Forest Service right now?
This one is Chevron.
Yes, it always did belong to the Forest Service. It raises a good point, too, because we don't know for sure right now all the precise requirements and regulations that people had to meet to build their homes. We know there was something. And I haven't seen anything in the company files, but that governed even the paint that could be used. You can use any color you wanted, as long as pastel, red, blue, no, not blue, red, green, and brown.
Yep.
That was it. But I think there were probably other rules that governed it, and I know some of the people are looking for that, because it would have governed the building rules for the town site as well. And I think it was Larry Howard was asking me about that. And they're trying to find some of that stuff. But the best they can do is find information in the government files, apparently,
of the general rules that the Forest Service had to implement regarding the building buildings on government land like this one.
Bill, you had one of the photographs last night showing the caving and some of the houses.
Yes.
So how many years after that did the Forest Service say you got it?
Yeah.
Oh, that late.
That
well, see,
down.
The one where the roof was caved in was yes. the last one we lived in, Terry.
Yeah.
And the reason why it caved in is the snow slid off of the roof.
Right.
And the ground and backed up in the
end. And that happened to be
Hey, Bill?
Okay. The county said they weren't both as strong.
That one was. That was in the
next
62?
Yeah.
Okay, it could be. I don't remember what year that was. It is written down.
And then a couple months after they had visited, they were gone. And everything.
Okay.
Next time they came, they were gone.
So here's probably there's a fuel tank sitting down there, I presume, but those would be the fittings for filling and venting one of the fuel tanks.
Do you remember how many gallons?
I have no idea.
It's like we would get ours filled in the fall time and.
Yeah.
It would take us through all winter.
That must have been a big change.
Yeah.
All winter?
Yeah.
Just one fill?
Uh-huh. Were your chimneys wrong?
Well, I don't think I can do that. My tank is 300.
Yeah.
A lot of places question.
Up here. Okay.
No, I can't do that.
I'll bet up here.
Oh, yeah.
I want to hike up there so bad.
I was going to say, I still have a prom number. I've got a screwdriver that's supposed to be on it. They give us some every year. It's not great.
Well, all this downhill side, of course, is obliterated for the septic system drain field. But Mrs. Field's house would have been somewhere in here, approximately. And the one house that we live in here would have been right there. These have been the third and fourth houses in from that corner. And I show that picture of the house on the corner with the great big deck on
yeah.
the back side.
Yeah.
That was right at the corner right now and there. And you can just imagine the great view from it right up.
Yeah.
There's a better view even up on the top there. Yes, it did. There was a tree on top and there was a green banner and that this morning. We ordered a number of it. The top was kind of high. There's kind of an interesting comment here that when the place closed down, people were free to do whatever they wanted with their homes. And there were two homes that were completely dismantled. And remember that the photo I showed of three of us up on Copper Peak and the one girl that was with me, Elaine Watson. And her family stayed here till the bitter end. And her father took their house completely apart. The company agreed to transport that house down the road, put it on the barge, put it down to Chelan. And from there, Mr. Watson apparently loaded it on some truck. And they went...
Orville.
Was it Orville?
Yeah.
And that, apparently they took the whole house with them. And there was one other house that was dismantled. And those were the only two. And then I showed that one house that was minus the windows. So people who did that. Hal Field liked his house, so he took the shingles off of his house. Took them down to Chelan and re-shingled their house down in Chelan. So there's various combinations of things that went on like that.
Yeah.
But the company
Yes.
Go ahead.
One of the controversies that came up during that time period, and it caught our mine manager, there were two issues. One was, obviously, nearing the end of production, what do you do? And how do you notify people that we are, in a formal way, even though unofficially anybody who had any smarts about mining and going in the mine would know that this was playing out. It was pretty doggone obvious to most people. And production, obviously, was falling off. But one of the issues, obviously, was when do you formally notify people that this mine is going to close on some particular date or approximately some date. And there were individuals, including Mr. Curzon, the mine manager at the time, said, we ought to be telling the people now. And unfortunately, he lost that battle. He went on to other things, and another person came in to manage the property. The other controversy was, what do you do about compensation, if anything, for the people who own the homes? And there were a lot of people at that point had put quite a bit of money in. And one of the rules was that in transferring a house to another family, another buyer, was to prevent gouging. In agreement with the Forest Service, you could not ever sell a house for more than what you had put into it, which meant that whatever you paid initially, the previous seller, whatever that price was, plus the price of the major modifications, not repair and maintenance, but say adding a room and that kind of thing, and adding up that total cost, that's the most you could ask the next buyer for that house. And the houses at that time, you're talking maybe $2,000 to $4,000, which was a significant amount of money back in 57. The company had reimbursed, this was something that I found out later, looking at some of the annual reports and that kind of thing. When Britannia opened up the mine for Howe Sound Company, they had individuals come down from Britannia Beach in British Columbia, and they built houses on Forest Service land with permits for the Forest Service and from the company, build houses at the, closer to the ballpark, the other side of Winston, and there was probably about a half a dozen houses, I remember. And then, when the place finally opened up, they brought in U.S. citizens to run it, and the Canadians went back home up to Britannia. The company did reimburse those people for what they had in their homes here. The company said, no, we're not going to do that. We have 101 homes. We're not going to pay them back. And that was a pretty sore point. But the company refused to do that.
So did some people still have loans and mortgages on their houses?
I don't know. You know, I can't verify one way or another. I have no idea. It's possible that they could have. They certainly would have been on the hook for it. And that's why used a couple of people dismantled their homes and took them with them or took them what they could.
But do you know what happened to Mr. Rogers? You're talking about all those kids or what happened to that family?
They had already moved out.
Oh.
By that time. And I don't remember what Mr. Rogers decided to do, but they moved out. The youngest of the family is Gail Rogers, and she went to high school in Chelan, and she married the son of one of the two brother Davidsons that worked together up here also, Bob Davidson. And they came back up here and in their own right, and I guess they lived up on the Dock Road in some place. We left them. Doesn't make much difference. And they had two daughters, and they were both born up here. And the youngest daughter was the last child to be born up here. It was about, I'm not sure of Linda's numbers in here compared to what she last told me, but I think there was a total of 16 children that were born up here. It wasn't usually the thing to do, because if there's any emergency, like I was explaining last night, there's really no fallback.
Yeah.
It'd be too late to get the mother out on the with the transportation we had out of here.
Yeah.
the early doctors, as I understand, like Dr. Wong, just absolutely refused to do it. It was just too risky.
But Gail was the youngest child of the that family?
Gail was, yes.
And she came back as an adult?
Yes.
Okay.
Right. They lived on bottom row, the third, second row, next to Allison's, which is on the corner, or maybe they lived in Morgan's house, because Morgan's moved up to Swihart's.
How long did the average family stay here? Would you guess? I mean, it probably varies all over the place, but you were one of the longest people up here?
Yeah, we weren't the longest. The Adams family, I would guess, was probably the longest. Mr.
Helen
Adams.
Florence.
Excuse me?
Helen Florence, too. They were the stable ones.
Oh, Howie.
Well, Florence yeah, they were here, yeah. But they were not the longest.
Uh-huh.
They were here from 39 to 57.
Uh-huh.
So they're among the longest. Mr. Adams came up here in March of 1937. His employee number was number 10. My dad was 430-something,
wow.
I think, and that was in July.
What changed your status from Wheaton to what did your dad start doing?
Well, he had a number of jobs. When he first got here, his first 5 years, he was a union worker, but a degreed engineer. He was working at hourly wages at that time. He worked underground, various jobs, and a surveyor. Then he went into engineering, and then we lived in Lucerne right when I was born. We lived in Honeyman Heights for, 3 years.
You did?
Yes.
I thought there was only couples, but families lived up there too, huh?
Yeah, I lived up there.
Wow.
I didn't show my pictures. I should have.
Yeah?
That would have been great.
It's in my family photo. Phil's family growing up in Holden.
Right.
I had shown it before. I'm standing on my dad's skis with his poles ready to go downhill. I like to show them. But anyway, I was about 2 years old, I think, at that time. And my brother, when he was born, we were already living up there. And there were a number of families.
Okay.
So then, as your dad worked his way up,
Of course, he's working as an engineer. I don't know exactly what all his responsibilities were, because every engineer had kind of a different responsibility, because the engineers were responsible for what was going on in the mine. That was their primary job. The metallurgist took care of the mill and all the how the concentration system worked and the chemical processes and that kind of thing. But mostly engineers were doing the underground. There were some safety engineers. There was a ventilation engineer. The ventilation fellow was responsible for the ventilation shaft, the draft doors that were inside the mine to prevent, and I'm an aerodynamicist, by the way, and the air blasting through the mine, which would create an internal wind tunnel, which you don't want. So there were blast doors inside, and there was an exhaust fan sitting right over in here. If you follow the road from the bottom of the mill up to the switchback to go to the 1500 level over here, right at the switchback, there's another road that goes west, and that goes out to the ventilation fan. I don't know if anybody up here has hiked over to it. Have you been over there? And I've heard that there's a fence around that area.
No, there isn't actually.
It's just these
huge 8-foot holes where the fans used to be.
Okay.
And then there's these wooden boards across the opening into the mine, but one of them is missing. So you can easily walk. I mean, like my size, I can easily crawl into the mine if I wanted. Or anything like that.
Let's hope you don't.
I hope you don't.
That's good.
Not when it's dripping from the ceiling and it's all.
Well, I know. A friend of mine years ago talked about, he worked up here in the very early years. He grew up here too. He would go up to the 1100 level. And you're not listening to me. And he crawled into the 1100 shaft and dangled. He climbed one of the ladders down to the lower levels. And I said, you've got to be nuts. I mean, those things have got to be just absolutely rotten. And he was by himself. Not that I ever did anything by myself.
This was years later, after the ladders had been used for a while.
That's right. Yeah, it was in the early years of the village, after everything was shut down.
someone's worked a little bit up here for the village.
Yeah.
And it probably hadn't been used for 6, 7, 8 years, something like that, I guess. I imagine all that stuff is pretty well rotten out. I went into a mine once. I had just turned 18. And I brought a classmate up with me, and my dad showed me around. And I'll tell you, it's just almost an absolute blank. I cannot remember getting my helmet with a light or my hard hat with a light and turning it in or taking showers. I can remember going up one shaft, which was probably one of these 100-foot shafts with a ladder, given it was straight up. I can remember standing next to the opening of a stope, and my dad threw a rock down the side, and he'd sit there and wait. You know, these stopes inside are 300, 400 feet tall, and several hundred feet wide this way, and depth of 100 feet or something like that, and you shine your light across, you don't see anything on the other side. It's just plain blackness, and your light goes out into nothing. And I didn't particularly like that. Then we went down to the lower levels, and back then I think it was just about the time that, well, expansion bolts were a fairly new invention, I believe, at that time. Kind of expansion bolts that you use for anchors. You have an expansion thing on the end of it, and you turn the thing, and that anchors into the rock. So you drill a hole, put the bolt in. These were probably about 3 feet long, as I remember, or something like that. They had head plates probably about that size, and they'd be all over the ceiling. And normally the mine didn't really need any structure inside. You know, if you listen to Norm Day and how they went into the 1500 at it, the first 80 feet, there's the structure that was replaced just a few years ago. And then beyond that, there's no need to have any support because it's all solid rock. But when you get down to the lower levels, because of the way they were doing the blasting and trying to leave structure, a lot of the rock is weakened pretty badly down in there. So they use these expansion bolts. And the lower the level, the closer the expansion bolt is what I remember. And needless to say, I worked for the aircraft factory. I got into rocketry.
When you said shower, did you have to shower to come out?
Yeah. Well, I don't know that it was a requirement, but I would say it was awfully a very good idea because it'd be pretty mucky. It was a wet and damp mine. And there was a building up there just outside of the 1500 level tunnel. We called it the dry, but it was the change house. And I'll show that this afternoon. But in there, they would change out. They had a chain and pulley system. It was kept quite warm in there. And draw the clothes near the ceiling, get them all dried out for the next day. Full shower and cleaning facilities in there. And in the same building, they had you could then charge out your batteries. For the headlamps, and they had a full charging system even back then for the headlamps. Yeah.
I've been talking with Larry, and he said that he doesn't know what the basement of the change house is.
Yeah,
do you know?
Yeah, I told him where it was.
Yeah, but do you know what the basement was used for?
Well, what the basement was used for?
Yeah.
No, I don't. Okay. Yeah, I don't. It may have been just storage, but I don't know what it was. I don't ever remember being in the basement at all. How are we doing on time? Let's see, up here, the postmaster lived up there, and there was, maybe it's still there, right in there, a concrete garage. I think it was one of the few garages that were up there.
Was the postmaster
No, he was employee of the federal government, just like they're all different places.
How long has it been?
Oh,
probably in the 5 to 8 year class, you might guess, there were a number of us who were, I promise you, you know, a real promise that you contracted pneumonia in the hospital and he did not recover from that.
He was still employed here?
Yes, he was.
Okay.
Who was that?
John Adams. Yeah. And then Linda Jensen, who normally does this tour, her father died of a heart attack. And at the road that went down up there, they lived near the downside portion of that road. She had an older brother, Jim, who was one of my best friends, and he and I usually partied up in the Boy Scout truck. But her father died of a heart attack up here, and the company was quite gracious to let them continue to live up here and stay in the house. She worked in the fountain lunch at the time. And then she always tells a story that they didn't know what to do. It came to spring, and school was out, now they had to move. How are they going to pack up everything?
Right.
And all of a sudden, some guys came up from the dormitory because they knew Mrs. Powell quite well because she served a lot of them and got to know them in the fountain lunch.
Yeah.
And they, the family just stood and watched, and these guys packed up everything. So it was a really great gesture. And then this was the other, that was a cul-de-sac up there, and this was the other cul-de-sac, and we're going to head back from here to get back to lunch. But I showed that two-gabled house, and it was right up in there. And then the other house I said was next to it was right here. And over on this side, on the right-hand side, was the first hospital. And they operated that hospital until 1938, when that current building, the Adopi, was finally completed. Well, we probably ought to go back for lunch.
Yeah.
So we can talk, we can ask questions, or on the way back, whatever.
You're going to come back out this afternoon after lunch?
Am I?
Up here?
I think I'm done.
What's the difference between where that road goes and this? We're standing on Middle Road. Oh, Middle Road, okay.
Now, this Middle Road continues and it goes over to, it's more or less the top of the hill, and there's another right-hand turn up here to Darlene's house.
Okay.
And you get up to the upper corner up here, and there was a short row up above up there. There was only three houses there, and then there was this stream and thicket of everything up there, and the down hillside, four houses, something like that. And then the ski area. And the little rope tour that I showed was in this corner up here. And this basically, that was the town's ski area as such. And originally, or I should say, in the early 40s, they had put in a ski tour up there. And I remember the first time I went up there, there was a kind of a cabin. And I think it was a cabin from one of the boats on the lake that they used for a little control house. And an avalanche, as I understand, this is before I even knew what was going on, but an avalanche came down and destroyed everything, and they didn't do anything. And nothing happened. And we walked around, you know, we hiked for an hour, skied down in a couple of minutes, hiked back up, and we'd go up here and we'd sidestep up and make ourselves a little course, and we'd ski that for about 100 feet. And until the Sullivans
came along and said, hey, why don't we get a rope tow up here? And that convinced the community club to invest in that rope tow that I showed with the Swedish rope tow, which it was called. I guess the parts of it were actually made by a company from Sweden. And so it was just a one-cylinder putt-putt sitting on a four-man toboggan. And then you just anchored it at the bottom. Well, there's a story associated with that. I was in high school at the time. I came home for Christmas, and I came up here to visit the Sullivans. I spent most of my time up here, I think, because he taught me a lot of stuff. And he says, well, our rope tow is at the top of the hill, not at the bottom. And he figured out it was better tow up more people, because usually you can only tow one. When I showed the picture of my father, of course he was a big guy.
He was a big guy.
But you can only have one person rope tow, or it would peter out. So he had put it up on the hillside underneath the cliffs. He said, well, we need to go dig that out. So can you join me tomorrow? So I said, yeah, great. So I got a snow shovel, and I was about 16 or 17. So we walked up there, and we were shoveling the thing out. We had a hole about this deep, I guess. And all of a sudden, Jim says, duck! I look up there, and my eyes get like this, you know, and here's a wave of snow coming down the hillside from underneath the cliffs about that high. That's not very much, actually. But it scares the devil out of you, because that's not what you would have happened. It just came around, swirled around. We were up to our knees. Just dug it out again. But not good. Not good. You really have to be very, very careful around here. And one of the trips that we took, spring skiing up here used to be just absolutely fantastic. Wonderful corn snow, and we all remember that. And about the end of March, when you have warm days and it freezes solid at night, so we put our skis on our shoulder and hike, starting about 6 o'clock in the morning up here, and everything was solid enough. So then we would hike all the way up into Holden Lake, and we'd eat lunch, and then on that side of Martin Ridge, and we'd climb up to the top of Martin Ridge.
Oh, gosh.
And this particular day, it had snowed. So we get up to the top, it's about 1 inch, about this much powder snow. Unbelievable. So we thought, man, this is really living. So we pointed the skis down, whoop-de-doo, through powder snow. And it was ideal.
Yeah.
Then of course you get down lower and the sun's hitting it and it goes to moosh. And then we hit the corn snow. And we were skiing right on the surface. It was just fantastic skiing until we got down to the bottom, and then of course you go.
Yeah.
I talk about that with my brother and he says, yeah, that's exactly what I remember too.
And did you get the globs of snow packed on your skis where you had to take them off and scrape it off?
No.
When it was that way, you were lucky.
Yeah. I knew how to wax. What was your problem?
We waxed, but we wore it off, so we had to stop and then do it again.
Remember going like this?
Well, yep. You're probably not going to have
that. So where did you end up going to high school?
Yeah. I went to a lakeside school in Louisiana.
Yeah. Well, I did a program this afternoon.
Yeah, from 4 to 5.
Okay, can I do a course this quarter?
Sure. If you guys want to continue doing that, go ahead.
Okay, after lunch, we'll meet one in the lunchroom. If you guys want to go on another part of the tour, I'll take you on.
Build a pond, and
trying to figure out how to jump into this pond, but it wasn't deep enough. It was very cold.
So you built, if you got that lean clip before you get to the program from the holding it, that lean down by the creek has some feet. I heard it was very soft.
Well, yeah, there was a lean clip down there. And I remember it was going up there in the afternoon. That was my first outing, actually. In fact, I think one of the pictures that remember my mother's photo album was exactly that trip. I came on to an iron skillet that couldn't fit it in my pack. Walking up this trail, dumped an iron skillet to go to that lease.
Wow.
Did you have to live with another family when you went to Lakeside?
Or
your head parents
moved
to Seattle?
No. Lakeside had a dormitory.
Oh.
About one third of the students were boarders, and the remaining two thirds were day students.
Okay. Did they stop that?
What's that?
Did they stop that?
Oh, yes, they did. Anyway. Right about 1965, one of the directors of the school, the trustees, decided that the money wasn't proper structure to serve the rest of the school. So they converted a dormitory down to the classroom. And then, of course, you know, later on, they combined with some other. It used to be up in top of the hill. Yes. Oh, yeah, more so. And that's one of the things we all kind of talk about Mrs. Field, because she was basically a superb woman. And she always, if she had your work done, for example, she would let you participate in the class ahead of you. And so that when you went through that grade, you're even more prepared. I think in my situation, going to the school out there, it's kind of formidable. And in contrast to another girl, like I talked about, she went to the red forest.
How old are you, Sandra?
I'm the bottom of the Capitol Hill.
Oh,
well, see, I had family. My mother's family lived in Seattle. And my dad's family also, you know, these forms again, but they both originally grew up in Seattle. And both got there as Miss Garfield.
Oh, my dad went to Garfield.
Did you?
My dad, yeah.
Yeah. And so I had one grandmother and my grandparents and my mother's aunt was both living there. So I always had family there. Every Saturday morning, doing this for 6 years, to pick up our laundry, take it to her place where she had a couple of, she owned and lived in an apartment house in Greenwood. And there was a walk and take care of the laundry, and that Saturday was to walk, drop off the clean, pick up the old. And we might be off on a trip or skiing or some doggone thing, and she just marched in the dormitory. And everybody knew Aunt Frieda.
Yeah.
I had to do that for some reason.
Yeah, that is.
Yeah. Well, in contrast, one of the other girls who went to Lake Forest, she said she was extremely lonely. She did not do very well. And she just kind of hated it. But she had no family. They had originally come from Canada, so they had no relatives in this area whatsoever. And she said it was a real, real trial for her. Then we had a couple of
Charles went to Gonzaga High School in Spokane.
Oh.
And they had an agreement with the university for how high school students were going there. Okay. So a couple of guys did that. And I think there was a girls' school, a private school there, too. And then there was Lanny Wright Seminary down in Tacoma, and a couple of girls went there.
It was a seminary?
Well, I think they called it that name. Oh. But I don't think it was right. Now it's the same, right? Yeah. And I don't know if it was Charles Wright School there, too, the boys' school.
Yeah.
And I don't know if anybody went there or not. I don't know if they had dorm capability or boarding capability there. They had no facility taking people outside the city. You know, Lakeside was the only one that had any capability to be Seattle or boys.
Was it really pretty spicy back then, too?
Yes, it was. Probably a little less so then, you know, but it still was a problem. And then some families sold their homes up here in Winston to another family. The father was living in a dormitory, and he took the family into the showing. I think I talked about that last minute.
Yeah.
And then they'd either rent or buy a house.
I bet they were glad once it closed down, the rest of the family didn't really have much notice.
Oh, yeah. They're very work. My friend Nigel went to Gonzaga for 2 years. I don't know why he took there, but he came back and then lived with close family friends in Atlanta after that year. And another lady I talked to didn't even go to school up here. I think her name moved. She was already a freshman in high school. Made me the entrance of the family in the mansion room. In exchange for a room and board, she was able to put the kids to the housekeeping. So she did that for all 4 years.
Wow.
She was attending the mansion life room.
That's a lot of responsibility.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So the pretty idea to grow up there, huh?
One thing I haven't mentioned, though, too, keep forgetting to, because there's no photographs to cover it, and that's the mother's, because she's got a little baby.
Oh. I didn't think about that, actually.
Yeah, you know, sitting in your house and getting cabin fever, you know?
Oh, yeah. I guess mom with the computer or whatever.
Right. But they had various guilds and bridgeports, and that's how they kept it. There was various guilds here that he was supporting building process in Seattle way back then. And